Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, July 13th, 2012, and today is the Vegan Athlete Show Part 2. And if you'd like to hear the Vegan Athlete Show Part 1, you can find it on our website at animalvoices.org. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Alon Cohen.
Hello, hello.
And Alyssa is away today. Animal Voices is Vancouver's and Western Canada's only animal advocacy and vegan radio program, bringing you all the animal and vegan-related news, events, interviews, lifestyle, and commentary you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and internationally. We at Animal Voices encourage the movement toward a world in which animals are treated with compassion and mercy and are afforded the same rights that humans take for granted. This program can be heard every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and is also streamed live at cooperadio.org and available as podcasts on iTunes and animalvoices.org after airing. We were going to have a main segment today that Alyssa was going to be presenting on veganism and spirituality, which I was really looking forward to. Unfortunately, Alyssa had an emergency that came up and she's not able to be here on the show today. So we are going to postpone that segment for later on this summer, as I'm actually going to be heading out for, I'm going to be missing 5 shows in a row starting next week, which is crazy because I don't think I've ever missed that many in a row ever. So just lots of things coming up, traveling, which we might talk about later, and work, and something else. So it just happens to be five shows in a row. So I really want to be part of this segment. So hopefully later in August we can present that veganism and spirituality segment. However, for our feature interview today, in line with the Vegan Athlete Show theme, we'll have with us a person who I consider to represent the ultimate embodiment of what is great athleticism, and it's all been done in following a plant-based lifestyle. We'll be speaking with vegan Ultraman triathlete and one of the world's fittest men, Rich Roll, on the show. He'll be giving us information and advice on various aspects of athleticism and the vegan diet from his own well-researched and experienced perspective. We'll talk about his training schedule and what he eats, protein requirements, and why a plant-based whole food diet is the most rapid recovery tool available to the athlete. Well, if you've ever wished to be inspired to make some dramatic changes in your life for the better, then Rich Roll's life story, as told in his book, Finding Ultra, is just what may be calling for you. This book speaks as a narrative volume that traverses through the experiences of one man's life, starting with athletic achievements from an early age to then alcoholism and self-abuse as a young man, to addiction recovery, and then to the eve of his 40th birthday, where he takes stock of his life and decides that he wants to be different than the lethargic couch potato that he has become. 50 pounds overweight, depressed, unhealthy, and unable to walk to the top of the stairs in his house without losing his breath, Rich Roll makes a decision to change his life around, and what ensues is jump-started by his resolution to adopt a plant-based diet. He takes us through his journey into these uncharted waters for himself, and we see how a typical inactive middle-aged man used to eating pizza, nachos, and potato chips makes the transformation by discovering that eating a vegan whole foods diet is the key to revitalized energy that had been lost upon him, and thus the start to his incredible feats as an ultra-endurance athlete. What is an ultra-endurance athlete, you might ask? There are people out there who cycle, run, and swim kilometers and kilometers at a time beyond what any average athlete will do. That is hundreds of kilometers. Without having ever completed any official races, an eagerness to persevere in his renewed athletic success due to his plant power diet, he decided to compete in the Ultraman Triathlon competition, which takes place every year in Hawaii and consists of, get this, a 10-kilometer ocean swim, followed by a 145-kilometer bike ride, followed by a 276-kilometer bike ride, and ending with a double marathon, that is 84 kilometers of running. And this is over a period of 3 consecutive days, 550 kilometers or 320 miles in total. It's considered to be one of the most challenging physical competitions in the world, and only the world's fittest humans do it. But in addition to competing and placing in the Ultraman competitions, Rich has also made an even greater physical achievement, if you can imagine that, which was taking on a challenge created by him and his friend, which they called the Epic Five, and consisted of five Ironman triathlons in less than 7 days. Epic for sure describes this Herculean feat. And fueling his success for all these grandiose achievements, he consistently credits his vegan diet. Rich is a striking model of inspiration of what can be physically and mentally achieved on a vegan whole foods regime. In the book, he states, "I can say with full confidence that my rapid transformation from middle-aged couch potato to Ultraman, to in fact everything I've accomplished as an endurance athlete, begins and ends with my plant-powered diet." And by reflecting on his life experiences, it causes you to consider your own lifestyle and how you may want to learn from reading about his own trials and tribulations to apply changes to yourself. Rich's voice is one of honesty, simplicity, and sincerity, which even more so makes for a compelling read that is hard to put down. It's relatable. Even if you may not be an Ultraman or Ultrawoman yourself, the ideas shared in this book, specifically on the logic of adopting veganism for optimum health, can be taken and applied to anyone. Ritual is just another testament following many others, for example, Brendan Brazier, Scott Jurek, Carl Lewis, and Venus Williams, just to name a few, of what incredible achievements athletes can realize by eating plant-based. Read this book if you're an athlete and you want to achieve better for your body and your health. Read this book if you're not an athlete and want to achieve better for your body and your health. Read this book to learn about living a clean and thriving lifestyle that incorporates physical fitness and optimal nutrition for an optimal life in general. You can only come out of reading this book by having learned through example of what successes one can achieve by living via a plant-powered diet. But it's more than just a diet, it's a lifestyle that embodies ultimate enrichment and fulfillment in whatever life goals you may pursue. So what do you think, Elon?
It sounds very exciting.
Want to read it? You can borrow my copy. I actually have a couple people who want to read my book, so I'm very willing to lend it around because...
He sounds like a very intense man.
Totally. He says that he does things either all the way or not at all. And that's his personality. And he has definitely taken that to the extreme in his ultra endurance athletics. That's for sure.
Definitely. But on that topic, of course, we did also want to chat about something that's nothing really new to the vegan community, and that is body shaming and fat phobia. And of course, while we're doing shows on vegan athleticism, I think it's important to actually talk about this topic, something we'll be actually addressing on a show next week. But as for now, I do want to talk about it a bit because oftentimes you have groups like PETA, and of course, you know, PETA is notorious for not being very helpful to the animal rights movement. But of course, often what they do is that they produce ads that often, simply put, they shame people to make them feel bad about their bodies. What it does, usually these ads suggest that people's appearances, people who are overweight, of course, they're an unpleasant annoyance to others and they're an undue burden. And of course, PETA's not the only one that does this. The PCRM, I believe that's the Physicians for Responsible Medicine. Physicians for Responsible Medicine also do this, of course. They actually released a commercial about somebody who was overweight, who sat on an airplane, and the idea that, you know, if you went vegan, you didn't have to sit next to them. And this is, of course, especially problematic.
Yeah, they said you could pay an extra, you should be able to pay an extra $10 to sit next to a slim vegan.
Of course, yeah.
I was shocked.
And it seems to me, I mean, on a very simplistic note, and of course, you know, this is something that, of course, anyone who's been involved in parenting, of course, knows, is that when you feel bad about yourself, you don't want to change anything. So the idea of body shaming, even as a tactic in and of itself, highly problematic and something that needs to be highly criticized, but it's not even an effective tactic. And here's a quote that I actually want to read from a doctor. His name is Dr. McDougall. He's an advocate for a vegan diet. He's from California. And he says that fat vegans have failed one important animal, themselves. Furthermore, their audiences of meat eaters and animal abusers may be so distracted by their appearance that they cannot hear the vital issues of animal rights and the environment, resulting in an unacknowledged setback for fat vegans' hard work for change. And I find this quote just simply disgusting. What it does, of course, is that it seems to be saying, it doesn't seem to be saying at all, what it actually does say is that because fat comes with a stigma of unhealthy, and vegans want to present the epitome of health, then fat vegans, of course, are bad for business. And of course, the same fat hate and social beliefs are present in the vegan community as in any other community. The idea that somehow fat people are lazy, gluttonous, and unhealthy. And of course, we want to be aware of the fact that you can be healthy at any size.
And unhealthy at any size, too.
And unhealthy.
There's a lot of skinny, unhealthy people.
Of course, just like the standard American diet contributes to obesity, but not all people who eat meat are fat. Neither are all vegans thin. And if this is something we want to be saying, because at the moment, where it just becomes a question of diet and about whole food, plant-based diets, it's merely a lifestyle. It's no longer about political engagement. It's no longer about activism. It's no longer about boycotting an industry which contributes to the massive and inhumane slaughtering of animals. It just becomes another lifestyle. And of course, this is probably why you often see maybe celebrities endorsing veganism. And I can see why communities, especially fat-positive communities, being ready against vegan lifestyles and vegan alternatives and vegan political action for specifically this reason. I think this is something that needs to be acknowledged. And again, this is something we want to actually do a show on, and we'll do a show on next week. And of course, once again, we always should know that most of the people that you see in your daily life that you think are fat and who identify as fat or what have you, they also know that they are fat, and most likely they're probably stigmatized with the trauma of having to go through a lot of weight loss, having to go through a lot of alternatives and diet plans that
or maybe not, maybe they like being that way.
That's true too, but I think the idea
fat
is that
positivity.
Often I think oftentimes organizations or animal rights groups that do these kind of adverts somehow assume that these people are just ignorant of whatever lifestyle they've chosen. And I think this is something that we always need to take into account, that we should always be giving people agency and the benefit of the doubt. And of course, we shouldn't be judging people. And veganism in and of itself, there's such a huge intersection between the two. I mean, just off the bat, thinking about it, just as it is, it seems to me that we often call people, and often people who are fat phobic, call people who are fat cows or whales and things like that. And this puts a negative spin on animals, just like we call
it. Could be insulting the animals.
Exactly, right? So there's a huge intersection there. But the other point of it is that vegans often complain about, and I often hear as well, about the idea of people policing your diet. You know, nobody really cares about protein or where you get your protein from until you become a vegan. And often that non-vegans complain and ask you.
We'll be talking about protein later in the show.
Exactly. And so it's very often that people criticize me and complain to me or attack me or want me to defend my position about veganism. And this is something that, of course, I imagine also people who identify as fat and fat positive people have to face as well. People have to defend their positions. And so there's a huge intersection, and there's a huge possibility of intersecting both communities, of making them allies, about the idea that we shouldn't be policing other people's eating habits, we shouldn't be policing their diets, and we shouldn't be policing their bodies. But of course, this is something that the vegan community fails to do. The vegan community that's obsessed with a lifestyle, that's obsessed with thinness and good looks. And of course, this is represented in organizations like PETA, where...
But it's not... Take note, it's not just the vegan community, it's our society as in general, as a culture.
Definitely.
North American society.
I mean, fat phobia is spread with that, of course, throughout all different intersections of society. And it seems to me a manifestation and an expression of different forms of oppression, specifically sexism, the idea that women specifically have to fit a certain body ideal in order to be attractive, in order to be valuable, because they're only measured by their sex appeal. And again, this is just another manifestation of patriarchy. Again, like people say continuously, that groups like PETA, of course, throw women under the bus in order to promote the vegan agenda. So this is something that we'll be returning to. And of course, I don't want to speak too much about it because I don't identify as fat, even as I want to be a fat positive ally. This is not my main struggle that I partake in. I don't have the best.
Well, I certainly identify, and I wish I could be there at next week's show because I think it's going to be great. I am taking class next week, but I'm really looking forward to your show next week, Elon.
So I think it'll definitely be great. So just to add that in, of course, that's the caveat. So even as much as we talk about athleticism and the idea of health, we do want to promote healthy at every size. Mm-hmm. And so that is something we think is very important to keep in mind, always in the back of your mind.
And then, as you had mentioned before the show, is, you know, we promote veganism for the animals, and it's a lifestyle, and that's really what it's all about. Yeah, sure, there are some people who are doing following the vegan diet just for dietary reasons, but it really is, it embodies a whole lifestyle of wanting to do the least harm.
Definitely.
And we've certainly talked about that on the show many times.
Progressive, magical, eclectic, groundbreaking, and a whole lot of fun. It's a festival that's been setting ears and hearts on fire for 3.5 decades. From July 13th to the 15th at Jericho Beach Park, and for the 35th time, the Vancouver Folk Music Festival delivers 2 days and 3 nights of amazing music from down the street and around the world. From the soulful sound of Columbia Gaita flutes to the triple time urban rhymes of Blitz the Ambassador, from Lucinda Williams's alt-country tunes to Bombalese's sizzling samba reggae rhythms, from the well-loved and familiar to thrilling new discoveries, over 60 performers from near and far gather to deliver a brilliant weekend of music just for you. Other feature artists include Dan Mangan, Ani DeFranco, The Head and the Heart, A Rosetta, Kanon, The Atomic Duo, The Barr Brothers, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, and many more. The Vancouver Folk Music Festival, July 13th to the 15th at Jericho Beach Park. It's a 35th birthday celebration you won't want to miss. Tickets and info at thefestival.bc.ca.
You're listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish Territories, Canada. And that was actually just an ad for the Vancouver Folk Festival. Are you going to that this weekend, Allison?
Nope. I'm engaged in co-op radio activities tomorrow in a different form, because co-op radio is going to be at the Folk Festival, but I'm also on the programming committee of the radio station. We have a 5-hour meeting tomorrow, so that's what I'm going to be doing.
Great. Well, I would actually be going there. And it's something that's, of course, a bit unfortunate about the Vancouver Folk Festival, that there isn't really a huge vegan advocacy associated with it. And of course, again, we see here the disconnect between veganism and animal rights and the environmental movement. But right now we have the events. If you want to help some pigs in need, there's actually a huge garage sale coming up, which supports our favorite mini pig sanctuary, Hearts and Noses.
We've had them on the show before.
Exactly. The garage sale will occur Saturday, July 21st, and Sunday, July 22nd, on 12th Avenue in Mission, BC. They certainly need a lot of help to make this a huge success. If you'd like to help by way of donating items prior to the annual fundraiser, they are looking for good quality items such as crafts, jewelry, vintage goods, collectibles, tools, and quality glassware. They also need help with setup and sales that weekend. For directions or donations, contact Janice at heartsonnoses@shaw.ca. Coming up on Friday, August 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Vancouver Central Library is a free film screening of Maximum Tolerated Dose, and I'm actually very excited about this movie.
Yeah, me too.
This film charts the lives of both humans and non-humans who have experienced animal testing firsthand, with hauntingly honest testimony by scientists and lab technicians whose ethics demanded they choose a different path, simultaneously heartwarming and heartbreaking stories of animals who have seen both sides of the cage. The film aims to reinvigorate the debate about animal testing by bringing these rarely heard perspectives to the fore. Maximum Tolerated Dose is a Canadian documentary by Carl Ozakowski and Decipher Films. The filmmakers will be present for a discussion after the film. Seating is limited. Be sure to bring your friends who don't know about animal testing. And you can learn more at MaximumTolerateddose.org. And just as kind of through the grapevine, the next day, actually, the directors and the people associated with the tour, there will actually be a protest in Vancouver on August 4th, but that's a bit of a still in the works.
You heard it here first.
Next, coming up on Saturday, September 29th, is Liberation BC's 6th annual Walk for Farm Animals, and it's time to register and get started fundraising. Last year, Vancouver raised nearly $12,000, the most of any Canadian city, and we plan to do it again. Registration is just $15, and children under 18 are free. All funds raised go to Farm Sanctuary's important rescue, rehabilitation, and outreach work. Setting up a donation page and getting a pledge form is a great way to raise awareness about farmed animals exploitation. Participants who raise $100 or more get a souvenir t-shirt. The event will be a family-friendly celebration of compassion featuring live music from the carnival band, costumes, face painting, balloon animals, delicious vegan food, and raffle prizes. It's one of the most exciting events of the year, and if it's not to be missed, if you have questions, you can contact Sophie at vancouver@walkforfarmanimals.org. Finally, we're happy to announce again the second annual Veg Fest Vancouver. Let's take over downtown Granville Street on Saturday, August 4th. If you're interested in volunteering or have a table at this event, please contact the organizers through the website at vegfestvancouver.com. And if you'd like us to help promote an animal-related or vegan event that's coming up in the Lower Mainland, please get in touch by emailing us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post the event to our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. And that's been your events for today, Friday, July 13th, 2012. And now we'll be chatting about the headlines. Modern drugs, of course, are something that are carefully studied than ever before, and this is something that we've talked about on the show quite frequently. After lengthy tests on animals, those considered safe and potentially effective enter very limited human trials. Only about 92% are then weeded out and deemed unsafe or ineffective, and that's only after the animal testing trials. The remaining 8% are some of the most closely scrutinized compounds on the planet. But at least 39 studies over 3 decades have ranked adverse drug reactions as an important cause of hospital deaths. Only heart disease, cancer, and stroke are more reliably lethal. Despite all this, figures that have just been released by the Home Office in Great Britain reveal that 3.8 million scientific procedures using animals were commenced last year, the greatest number since current records began 25 years ago. 71% did not use anesthesia of any kind, which sounds to me quite horrendous. Although painkillers are sometimes given, often they are not, partly owing to concerns that this may affect the experiment's outcomes. Over 72,000 more fish were used in procedures than last year, and over 20,000 more birds, and of course, as always, the number of rats and mice has been increasing exponentially. This may be explained by the increase of zebrafish testing, and also the number of cats tested increased by 25%, which represent a total of 48 more cats than the 2010 figures. What's quite notable about this, though, is that universities and medical schools are now the biggest animal testers, overtaking commercial organizations in 2002. So what this has been saying is that since 25 years ago, commercial organizations have been reducing their testing on animals, so things like cosmetic and other such practices have been reducing, and universities have been increasing their testing on animals. And right now, we've had the most number of testing in the UK since the records have ever been recorded. So this is something obviously quite worrisome to think about. In Panama City, the International Whaling Commission ended its annual meeting on Friday amid dissatisfaction from a variety of members, including Japan, which sought permission for coastal communities to carry out small-scale whaling. A lack of consensus scuttled a proposal by Monaco to increase protection of whales, and the principality said that it would take its case to the United Nations. Japan threatened to withdraw from the conference if its proposal continued to be blocked. Denmark issued a similar warning after the Commission rejected its request for a whaling quota for indigenous groups in Greenland. The International Whaling Conference banned commercial whaling in 1986 due to the threat of extinction for many whale species. Japan hunts whales for purportedly scientific purposes, which many environmental groups describe as a front for commercial whaling. Nations including the United States and Mexico say research can be carried out on whales accidentally caught in fishing boats' nets. But of course, this is something we want to politicize in and of itself. The fact that whales are caught in fishing boats' nets is not something that should be normalized and seen as something that where scientific research can happen on accidental bycatch. The Whaling Commission still must consider a proposal by South Korea to resume purportedly scientific whaling, which the U.S. and other countries are expected to oppose when it's formally presented at a meeting of the IWC Scientific Commission next year. And there's one other story that I want to talk about that's actually very interesting, I find, to be quite exciting. There was actually panic at a German zoo as five chimpanzees created a makeshift ladder out of branches and jumped out of their pen.
And what escaped, happened, right?
They jumped out of their pen. They stayed within the zoo arena.
They wanted to escape.
Yeah. So, of course, what happened is that they actually scaled the wall, and they walked among the 2,500 visitors by creating, like I said, a ladder essentially fashioned out of different kind of tree branches and twigs and such things as that. The irony of the whole story is that in the whole escapade, one could say, two people were actually harmed. A five-year-old girl hurt herself, and an elderly man also hurt herself. What happened was is that the five-year-old girl fell over at the sight of the chimps, but she wasn't seriously injured, and an elderly man also needed medical attention when he was locked in a tropical house in 100-degree heat as the chimps roamed outside. More than this is that after the chimps roamed around for a while, four of the five of them actually just went back to their enclosure. The leader of their pack, whose name is Maxie, enjoyed himself on the outside, and he actually went to go see the head gorilla, who was located at another pen. And of course, he was a bit harder to coax back, but what the zoo officials, I guess the people who take care of the animals there, what they did is that they actually gave him a ladder to climb back into the enclosure, and then he went in there. So, of course, it's something very interesting to keep in mind that these animals realize their fate, realize that...
You know they're in jail.
They know that they're in jail. They went out, and on their own accord, they went back into their pen.
This story really made me think of a book that I read. I think it was about a year ago, or maybe it was 2 years ago. It's called Fear of the Animal Planet, The Hidden History of Animal Resistance. And we actually had the author on the show to speak with us about all these different stories of captive animals, and they do try to escape. His name is Jason Hirabal. If you go onto our website, animalvoices.org, and look that up, you can listen to that interview, and I recommend reading the book as well. Well, thank you for today's headlines. And today's feature interview is with Rich Roll, a graduate of Stanford University and Cornell Law School. Rich is a 45-year-old world-renowned vegan ultra-endurance athlete, wellness advocate, husband, father of four, and inspiration to people worldwide as a transformative example of courageous and healthy living. Transforming his life at age 40 from a typical sedentary lifestyle and standard American diet, he adopted a plant-based diet and reinvented himself as an ultra-distance endurance athlete. Just a few years later, Rich clocked top finishes in the Ultraman World Championships, a double Ironman distance triathlon totaling 320 miles and widely considered one of the most grueling endurance events on the planet. And then later he became one of the first of two people to complete the Epic Five, five Ironmans on five Hawaiian islands in under a week. Rich's plant-fueled feats of boundary-pushing athleticism have been featured on CNN as well as in many mainstream newspapers and magazines. In 2009, Men's Fitness magazine profiled Rich as one of the 25 fittest men in the world. Rich Roll is here today to speak with us about athleticism and what he calls the plant power diet. Hello, Rich, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hey there, thanks for having me.
And you're in an airport right now. I'm excited to have you here today. I've just finished reading your highly captivating and inspiring book, which distinguishes you as an ultimate model for the physical and mental feats that one can accomplish on a whole foods plant-based diet. So thank you for writing the book. I'd like to start at the beginning of your story of transformation. On the eve of your 40th birthday, you took inventory of your life and decided that you wanted to make a change to turn your life around. So you did a liquid cleanse and subsequently adopted a plant-based diet. And what resulted from this? You say in the book that what followed was a miracle altering your life's trajectory forever.
Yeah, it's true. It's been an incredible journey and one that I could have never predicted in a million years. And, you know, like you said, on the eve of my 40th birthday, I was basically an overweight junk food addict and couch potato. Took a stab at a plant-based diet with very low expectations. I didn't really have any high hopes of it changing my life, certainly. I mean, at best, I wanted to, you know, lose a little bit of the gut around my waist and, you know, just be able to have some increased energy so I could enjoy my children at their energy level. And I was quite astounded to realize just how everything in my life changed. I mean, starting with this tremendous boost in vitality and energy, that has, you know, reinvigorated my life and repaired my health and given me the interest, the desire, and the energy to pursue these crazy endurance conquests that I've been doing the last couple of years.
What is your take on consuming animal protein and animal products? What does this do to our health?
Well, I think there's a lot of misinformation out there, and it's getting better and better. I mean, I think there's never been a better time than now where people are more open to the health benefits of the plant-based diet. But the truth of the matter is that animal protein and animal products are not only not necessary, they're counterproductive and in many cases disease-provoking. And, you know, we live in a culture now where obesity, diabetes, and heart disease rates are through the roof, and there's no indication that they're slowing down. And when you really look at the hard facts and the science, it's clear that there is a very strong correlation between the ingestion of animal proteins and animal products and the onset of these congenital infirmities that are actually very easily avoidable.
In your book, you state with full confidence that an alkaline, plant-based, whole food diet is the most rapid recovery tool available to the athlete and a crucial component to your success. You say that everything you've accomplished as an endurance athlete begins and ends with your plant-powered diet. Can you talk about how eating plant-based whole foods affects your training and recovery?
Yes, certainly. I think, you know, from the outset, I would say that some people sort of misattribute this to me and say, oh, you're saying that eating a vegan diet, eating a plant-based diet inherently makes you a better athlete. So if you become vegan, you're automatically a better athlete. And it's not quite, that's not quite what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that when you're eating a plant-based whole food diet with lots of alkaline forming foods, that this in turn serves to expedite your recovery in between workouts. So in other words, the time it takes my body to repair itself in between my training sessions is decreased, it's reduced. And so that allows me to train harder, bounce back more quickly, and also keeps my immune system chugging along in a healthy way at its optimum peak so that I don't get sick, I don't get overtrained. And so when you extrapolate that out over a period of time, over the course of the season, we're going to be able to train more efficiently, more effectively, and that is going to result in performance gains as an athlete.
And eating just a vegetarian or vegan diet isn't automatically a magical prescription for good health, as you personally discovered when you first transitioned. Can you talk a bit about the dangers of eating a poor plant-based diet as opposed to a whole foods one, especially when it comes to athletic performance?
Yes, certainly. You know, when I first began this journey, before I went entirely vegan, I went vegetarian, and I wish I could say I read a bunch of books and did a bunch of research and did it, you know, the perfect way right out of the gate, but that was not the case. I mean, certainly you can eat very poorly on a vegetarian diet and on a vegan diet as well. I mean, on a vegetarian diet, you could eat Domino's pizza and McDonald's french fries all day long. Technically, you're a vegetarian, and the same holds true as a vegan. There's plenty of vegan junk foods out there, and, you know, I think there's a lot of great sort of meat substitutes and dairy substitutes out there that are great, you know, sort of bridges for people that are interested in a plant-based diet but are still kind of craving that cheeseburger or that, you know, that cheesy flavor. And they work well for sort of getting people to experiment with this kind of diet. But in truth, a lot of those products are not very healthy. They're processed, you know, in the same way that a lot of the animal products that you see at the grocery store are processed. And so they're not great for you. So it's very easy to eat poorly on a vegan diet. And you know, I think going back to this sort of alkalinity versus acidity, you know, question that we talked about earlier, I mean, your body has to work very hard to maintain a homeostatic pH. And the typical standard American diet is very acid-forming. The animal products, dairy products, the processed foods, when combined with, you know, the high stress that we experience in most of our lives and the sort of environmental toxins, the air we breathe, et cetera, all contribute to what we can call a state of chronic acidosis. And that is a state in which your body has to work overtime to kind of balance your pH. It runs you down, attacks your immune system, and it's an environment that's ripe for the development of many of these congenital infirmities that I talked about before. Everything from, you know, getting the flu and cold to, you know, heart disease, diabetes, and the like. So when I talk about eating vegan, what I'm talking about is eating a whole food plant-based diet. Those are fruits, vegetables, legumes, grains, close to their natural state, which tend to be alkaline forming, keeping your body, you know, operating at its peak.
In our modern culture, we see a lot of food products in grocery stores and marketed on TV and magazines, etc., mostly animal-based or laden with animal products, and all claiming to be good for you in one way or another, low-fat, no-fat, free-range, high in protein, etc. Depending on how you choose to inform yourself, sometimes this myriad of choices as fed to us by various contenders of corporate food industries can be confusing to wade through to decide on for ourselves. Can you give us your views on the corporatization and marketing of food and health, even as it pertains to athletes, who are certainly very susceptible to these messages as well, as many athletes still do eat a lot of meat and other less than optimal offerings of the standard American diet?
Sure, of course. I mean, certainly, you know, we're so bombarded with these marketing messages that are delivered to us by Madison Avenue and the very powerful food industry lobbies, the meat and dairy industry and the like, who, you know, have packaged these foods in such a way to convince you that they're healthy. And, you know, it's enough to cause vertigo. Just going to the grocery store, it's almost impossible to decide what to get because every product has a label on it saying high in omega-3 or high in protein or low in fat, et cetera, et cetera. And it's very difficult even for the most educated consumer to kind of wade through that and make a well-informed decision. So, you know, the truth of the matter is that the rule of thumb is stick to the sides of the grocery store where the produce is, the fresh organic produce. Just keep eating foods that are natural and close to their natural state, organic produce, like I said. So if it has a label on it with a bunch of chemicals or something you can't pronounce or it's trying too hard to convince you that it's good for you, then, you know, it's probably a good idea to stay away from that. And, you know, this is true for athletes as well. I mean, there's a big controversy going on right now because Arian Foster, who is a very, very talented NFL running back, has decided to go vegan. Mm-hmm. So all these people and all these football fans and ESPN are up in arms and, you know, saying that this is a terrible idea, and I've been listening to interviews with the pundits on the television talk shows, and they're so misinformed, you know, they really are. It's almost not their fault. It's because we live in a culture that has been carefully crafted to deliver these messages about what's healthy and what's not, that they sift down all the way to our food pyramid, which is influenced by the FDA, which is in many ways, you know, in the pockets of these powerful lobby industry. So, you know, like I said, it's just beef plants close to their natural state. And when you see an ad, you know, that's advertising that chocolate milk is the ultimate recovery, you know, food for an athlete, and you see your favorite athlete holding that chocolate milk, well, you have to kind of read between the lines. Like, well, what's going on here? You know, and when I look at that, I see, well, you know, plant-based nutrition is gaining a foothold, and people are thinking twice about dairy and drinking milk. And so what's the dairy industry do? Well, let's repurpose this chocolate milk, which has always been sort of marketed towards children as a fun thing to drink, and turn it into an athletic recovery food. And it's really just marketing, plain and simple. So, you know, when you look at these labels, don't take them at face value and try to understand what's going on between the lines.
I'd like to talk about your athletic training now. To get some perspective on the rigorousness of your training schedule and lifestyle as an athlete, can you give us an idea of what your training might involve in one day? How many miles each day are you cycling, swimming, running, for example, or per week?
Well, every week's different. I mean, I would say that, you know, I'm not a professional athlete. You know, I am a husband, and I have four children, and I'm a practicing attorney, and I'm a writer, and I have lots of things going on in my life, and I don't get paid to race and or anything like that. So, you know, I have to find the time to balance my training against, you know, my family obligations, which obviously come first, and my professional obligations. So every day is different. I have to try to squeeze my work out in around the kids' schedules and my work schedule. So it's hard to say what a typical day would be, but I would say this, that when I'm in peak training and I'm getting ready for a big race, like Ultraman, for example, the training weeks will range anywhere from 15 to 25 hours a week, 25 hours at its peak, and it will generally involve a bike ride of anywhere from 2 to 4 hours on a weekday, and on Saturdays I do really long rides, upwards of 8 hours of time. Some days are very long runs, anywhere from 3 to 5 hours. And during the week, they're shorter workouts, but I'll try to do 2 a day, like maybe a swim in the morning and a bike ride in the afternoon, or a trail run in the morning and a bike ride in the afternoon. Every day, like I said, every day is different. But it's a big commitment, and in many ways, it's like a second job for me.
And so you must be expending an enormous amount of energy and thus need to refuel that energy with proper nutrition. On such a training week as you've outlined, what types of foods would you be taking in during the week and during the day? To start, what would your breakfast be, and then followed by what kinds of foods throughout the day up until bedtime?
Sure. Well, the first thing I would say is that nutritional density is very important. So what I mean by that is eating foods that have a high degree of nutritional value by weight or by calorie versus empty calories. So I usually start the day with a Vitamix blend. My Vitamix blender is my best friend, and your listeners probably know what a Vitamix blender is.
Yep.
But if you don't, it's like looks like a regular blender, but it's extremely high powered. It has a motor on it that will literally make cheese out of anything. I'll start the day with a blended drink that has kale and spinach and spirulina, lots of nice dark leafy greens. I like beets and beet greens that boost endurance, and then I'll throw some berries in there for antioxidants. Some superfoods, too, which I love experimenting with and trying to figure out how they affect my system, like chia seeds, hemp seeds, maca powder, acai, and like that. If I'm particularly hungry in the morning, maybe I'll have a bowl of cold quinoa with coconut milk and berries and black seeds or hemp seeds on it, or even chia seeds as well. And then during my training sessions, I try to take in about 100 to 200 calories an hour. And for that, I try to stick to whole foods. I try to avoid those gels and the Gatorades and the Vitamix and the food gels that lots of athletes prefer. They're laced with all sorts of chemicals and additives and stuff like that I don't like to put in my body. So I'll opt for things like sweet potatoes or rice balls or bananas and coconut water for electrolytes. And then post-workout, it's important to replenish your glycogen stores. You try to do that within about 30 minutes of your workout. So for that, it's another Vitamix blend. And sometimes I'll include some plant-based protein powder in there to, repair the muscle tissue. And then brown rice with veggies, veggie burritos, lentils over steamed rice, again, keeping it simple. For snacks, I like to have a bag of almonds in my car, and I'll always make some extra Vitamix blend to take with me when I'm driving around, over the sprawl of L.A. throughout my work day. And, I usually eat a larger dinner, usually a big salad with lots of dark leafy greens and different kinds of vegetables in it. And dinner could be brown rice pasta. I try to eat gluten-free, so I try to stay away from the wheat-based products and the breads and things like that. And then again, lots of beans for protein, veggie chili, vegan lasagna. My wife's a fantastic cook. She makes it a lot easier. She's always coming up with amazing new recipes. But I guess that's it in a nutshell.
That's it. Let's talk a little about protein. I know you get asked about this all the time, but I feel that we have to keep giving the information to people until everyone is educated when it comes to knowing about true protein requirements for athletes as well as sedentary people. Can you talk about what the protein requirements are for an athlete or non-athlete and how one can best take in these requirements on a plant-powered diet?
Sure. I mean, of course, I get to ask this question almost on a daily basis, and it's it's the thing that everyone wants to know. Everybody presupposes that if you're going to eat a plant-based diet, that you're going to suffer some kind of protein deficiency. And again, it goes back to, you know, the meat and dairy industry wanting you to believe this. But the truth of the matter is that there's a wide array of plant-based foods that are high in protein. And there has been no study that has ever established that taking in more than your RDA protein, which is about 10% of your calories, has any added benefit on athletic performance or recovery. So my caloric intake of protein remains at around 10%, just like it would be for the average person, and I've never experienced any issues with regards to building lean muscle mass in the years that I've been pursuing my career as an athlete in middle age. And you know, some of the foods that are high in protein that I like to eat are quinoa, which is, people think it's a grain. It's actually a seed, but it's delicious. It's a good substitute for rice or pasta. It's great with veggies, and again, it can work as a breakfast cereal as well. So I eat lots of quinoa, lots of lentils, lots of beans, all different kinds of beans. Hemp seeds are great, too. You can put them in your Vitamix blend, or you can put them on your cereal or on salad. Spirulina, which I put in my blends also, is the highest concentration of protein per weight of any food on Earth, including meat and dairy products. And then as far as soy products, a lot of people, you know, like to eat a lot of tofu, certainly, you know, high in protein. I prefer to not eat too much soy, and this is a fermented non-GMO soy, so I like miso and I like tempeh, but I try to not overdo it on the tofu.
You talk a lot in the book about all the wonderful and nutritious plant foods that you eat, and because you're not eating a lot of prepared foods that come in packages, that is, you're eating real food, it must take quite a bit of organization, I would think, to get into the habit of acquiring and preparing all these foods. You're also a very busy person, so I'm wondering if you can bestow some tips of advice upon our listeners on how to easily incorporate plant-based foods into one's life for their athletic and everyday health. How does one make it a habit to transition to a plant-powered diet from, say, the standard American diet, and what would your top practical tips of advice be to athletes who want to adopt this lifestyle?
Well, it's a great question, and again, I think a little bit of it goes back to these misconceptions. You know, there's sort of a firm belief that eating vegan is very difficult, it's time-consuming, it involves a lot of prep time, and, you know, items are difficult to source and the like. And I just really, quite honestly, have not found that to be the case. Now, certainly, if you're traveling a lot and you're going out of town, you know, it requires a little bit of, you know, planning ahead to figure out where the, you know, the natural market is in the town that you're going to, or where the restaurants are that you can eat, et cetera. But in general, you know, if you have stocked your refrigerator, even at any grocery store, with lots of different kinds of varieties of, you know, the items that I already listed, then it's not that difficult, quite honestly. And the prep time, the recipes are not that intricate because really, again, we're talking about preparing food close to their natural state. We're not trying to recreate the cheeseburger or the meatloaf and make it taste like that. We're trying to enjoy these foods the way that nature intended them to be. So, like I said, you know, whipping up a salad or something like that, it's really basic, simple stuff. And I think once you sort of break the craving habits that come along with the standard American diet, you'll find that you really enjoy these foods and you will not find them bland, because I think that's the other misconception. People think everything tastes bland, and I disagree entirely. The foods are delicious, and, you know, once you start to really lean into them, you'll realize that you're going to enjoy them more than you might imagine. But, you know, there are certain things that require a little bit of forethought. So in terms of tips that you ask, one tip that I use on a daily basis is with my Vitamix blend. When I make my morning drink, I'll make a whole giant Vitamix blend. You know, I'll fill the blender all the way to the top, but I'll just have a glass of it, and I'll put the rest of it in the thermos. And then I'll take that with me throughout my day. So whether that's in my, you know, satchel or in my car, I always have that at the ready. So if I start to get hungry and I'm, you know, driving across Los Angeles or whatever, and there's no, you know, place where I can stop in and get something to eat, I can take a hit off that Vitamix and, you know, fortify my body and sort of keep those cravings at bay and prevent myself from, you know, making an unhealthy food choice. Another thing that we do is, you know, once a week we'll just make a giant pot of lentils or brown rice or black beans, and then we put them in the refrigerator. So then, you know, I can get a Tupperware thing out and, you know, put some brown rice and black beans in there with some hot sauce, and I can also bring that with me during the day. So, for example, as a lawyer, I have to go to a lot of business lunches, and, you know, if that lunch happens to be at a steakhouse where I know probably the only thing I'm going to be able to order is a salad or some spinach and a baked potato, then, you know, on route to the restaurant, I can kind of, you know, eat some beans and rice in the car, and so I'm not so hungry. And then I can go in and I can enjoy my meal, and I won't be tempted to, you know, order the thing that I'm not supposed to order. Another tip would be to not overthink it. Don't overcomplicate it. Like, just begin. Just begin by incorporating more plants into your diet. You know, don't try to be perfect right out of the gate. Just try to make the next best choice. And don't worry about tomorrow, because I think when people get into, oh my God, I can never have pizza again, I can never have a cheeseburger again, they panic and say, oh, well, this is impossible, and then they don't even try. But I think if you found that if you just began by sort of making your dinner, for example, predominantly plant-based, then, you know, if you can't let go of that chicken breast, then just make it a small little side dish for now and make the salad and the lentils the focus of the meal instead of the side dish, and see how you feel. Once you start to feel better, then you can kind of take it to the next level. You can kind of trade in that milk for almond milk or coconut milk, and before you know it, you know, you're headed in the right direction. And as you begin to feel better and see how your body feels, you're going to want to lean into it a little bit more.
I want to talk about spirituality now, as I know that you consider yourself to be a spiritual person. What role does veganism play in your life when it comes to the spiritual aspects of the lifestyle, and how do you feel about your impact to the earth with regards to animals?
Well, I think it's all spiritual. Now, I'll be the first to admit that I got into this initially for health reasons, and I guess that's somewhat selfish, although, you know, I did it because I wanted to be around for my family. But, you know, I wasn't initially concerned about the planet or the animals. My grandfather, who had been a champion swimmer in his youth, had died very young from a heart attack. And my mother, my whole life, had told me, you've got to be careful. But, you know, when you're young, it's just sort of in one ear and out the other. And, you know, it all caught up to me. And I really did fear that I was going to have a heart attack and die young. So that was, you know, initially my rationale for getting into this. But as I've sort of walked this path and experienced this journey, you know, I've realized how much of a spiritual journey it is. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that the old adage, you know, you are what you eat, is true. And food is energy. And food carries with it a vibration. And, you know, when you make a food choice, you are choosing to take that vibration into your body, into your spirit. And that affects everything. Everything from how you feel energetically to, you know, the thoughts and decisions that you make and your perception of the world. And I found that, you know, when I'm eating a whole food plant-based diet, that I have a certain clarity and perspective that I didn't used to have. And I think it's impossible to not recognize and embrace the other sort of issues that come along with this lifestyle, such as the way that we treat our animals and, you know, the system that we've erected in our society, the system of factory farming that is torturing animals by the millions and, you know, literally using them and abusing them and discarding them, you know, for our own benefit. And, you know, like I said, that is a vibration that is violent and unnecessary and harmful. And I think when you remove that vibration from your soul and from your body, you can feel the difference. And so I've become much more interested in advocacy in that arena than I was initially. And, you know, certainly there can be no argument that eating a plant-based diet isn't the most ideal way to take a stand for the environment. I mean, it's, you know, eating a plant-based diet has a much more profound effect on the planet than driving a Prius at this point. And if everybody went vegan, I think this world would be a much better place, a more peaceful place, a more community.
Thank you so much, Rich, for coming on the Animal Voices show today to speak to us about optimal athletic performance on a plant-based, plant-powered diet. It has been a great pleasure to speak with you and to learn from you. I encourage our listeners to read Rich's book, Finding Ultra, to read all about his incredible life. You can also find him online at findingultra.com and at his personal website, richroll.com.
Great. Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver Coast Salish Territories, Canada. Next week on the show, we'll be doing an interview on body shaming. We'll actually be discussing body shaming, fat phobia, and veganism like we did earlier on the show. Related to this discussion of the body and policing the body in regards to desire, we'll also be chatting about veganism and being queer / trans. We here at Animal Voices show modestly ask you to keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web, the internet. You can do so by signing up on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show, either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Also, please do check out our website, animalvoices.org, where our shows can also be downloaded. If you appreciate the work we do here every week at Animal Voices to bring you original quality programming on the topics of current animal issues and the vegan lifestyle, please do show us your support by making a donation if you can and if you want to, to us at Animal Voices at Co-op Radio, because we do rely on your donations, of course, to keep the show on the air. And to make a donation, you can simply go to co-opradio.org and click on Donate Now and indicate Animal Voices as a show that, of course, you most love. And if you're in Canada, your donations are tax deductible if they're over $25.
What song do we have?
Well, you can stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. And the song that we do have, what song do we have? We have...
It's called Change by the vegan band called One World Revolution. And it's in recognition of making a change to your lifestyle, as Rich did, if that's something that interests you.